Hello and welcome to the second audio diary of the Urban Farmers. My name is Jim Kiernan and joining me as always is my good friend and fellow urban farmer Joel Bensley. Joel, mate, it's good to see you. How have you been?
Yeah, I've been well, thanks, Jimmy. It's work's been very busy and consuming a lot of my time, but yeah, I've been going well, thank you. How about yourself?
Mate, just as busy. I'm probably the busiest I've been at work in my whole career, to be honest, the amount of priorities we've got at the moment. And then in my personal life, you know, packing, getting ready for the move and everything, so just absolutely flat out.
Yeah, it can be very taxing.
Yep. So, moving along, for those of you out there who are new to the show, The Urban Farmers is how Joel and I document and share our learning and experiences during a time in our lives where we're currently shifting our way of life towards a more sustainable and self-sufficient lifestyle. Now, we engage with the community via a number of different fashions, such as this podcast, but you can also follow us on Twitter at Urban Farmers TV, or alternatively, you can catch us on Facebook at facebook.com, The Urban Farmers. So, as I mentioned, this is a time of learning for us both, and we hope to share our failures as well as our successes, but ultimately we'd like to encourage feedback from you, our listeners, and the community. In addition to this, if you have any questions or you'd like to share your own experiences or any advice you'd like to share with the show, you can do this by sending an email to info@theurbanfarmers.tv. And of course, you can jump over to our website at theurbanfarmers.tv where you can find all the links I've just mentioned, including our YouTube page where we post videos showing the sorts of things we're up to on a fairly regular basis. We also post all our show notes from the audio diary that include links to anything we discuss in the show for you to go and have a look at if you're interested. Now, Joel, last time we spoke at length about your new chooks. How are they going, mate? I'm interested to see how many eggs you're getting on a daily basis.
Yeah, well, we're getting pretty solidly 5 eggs a day now. Occasionally it's 4, and then I have to get the whips out on them. But it's normally 5, and you know it's pretty solid 5. And actually, something interesting I've noticed since taking more time looking at the chooks and looking at the egg quota and everything that's happening there is that we've got 6 birds. But 5 of them look identical, and there's one that I always thought was a younger bird, but I'm starting to wonder if it's slightly different breed or it's a crossbred or something. All the other birds have got quite whitish feet. They're all supposed to be ice browns, and have got very similar coloured feathers. Now this other bird has similar coloured feathers, but more of like a lighter coloured.
Yeah, I know the one actually you're talking about.
Yellow feet. Much quicker bird to get around the yard. The hardest one to catch is a bit of a troublemaker. I'm not sure if she's laying.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Maybe if it's not laying, that's where the energy's coming from.
Yeah, possibly. So it's just interesting and something I'm going to follow a bit more closely. And, and I'm even thinking about separating her from. The others give her a really hard time too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and just interesting, just a bit different. And we're getting, you know, they were a point of lay when we got them. We're getting virtually 5 eggs a day. In their first year, you normally get 6 eggs a day. And they're, oh, I'm happy with 5 a day. That's fantastic. But just curious as to whether she is a slightly different breed and whether, or if it's just a, you know, a coincidence that 5 have these whitish coloured feet and she's got these bright yellow, like it's...
Yeah, that's really interesting. I know the bird you're talking about.
Yeah.
So maybe, yeah, separate it from them. And if you're still getting 4 to 5 eggs a day, then...
And if she doesn't lay any in the time that she's separated, it's just an interesting...
Yeah.
Interesting
maybe
thing.
She'll end up being a nice table bird instead.
Well, that's right. That's the beauty of the chicken, isn't it, I suppose. So, you know... A bird that's laying eggs eats the same amount as a bird that's not laying, so...
We might get some photos of the different birds up there, that one specifically, and see if anyone can give us some feedback and if they recognise it as a different breed.
It's an interesting thing that we've picked up lately that...
Yeah, that's good.
And she seems to get... Originally, I thought she was just...
Younger.
Yeah, younger. But not quite... Hadn't reached maturity yet, as the others had. And look, that possibly still could be the case that... She definitely looks similar in colour, but there is those distinct differences.
Yeah, colour only tells one part of the
same.
Story, doesn't it?
Yeah, but yeah, we're sort of getting solidly 4 to 5 eggs a day, most times five, which is just, it has been fantastic. And through the week, I thought I'll have eggs on toast for brekkie.
Mm.
And I went into the fridge to pick out a couple of eggs. And one of them I picked out was quite a large egg. And I said to Dee, geez, look at the size of this egg. And she said, yeah, wow. And I said, I wonder if it's a double yolker. And she said, I was thinking it was a double yolker. And sure enough, I cracked it into the pan and it was a double yolker. So
nice.
Yeah, it was.
So do you class that as 6 that day? Because really, it's all about the yolk.
No, but, well, I suppose it was good. Bring on more of those, I say.
It was
fantastic. So
that's a highly productive bird.
Yeah. So no, they're going well, and they're being enjoyed.
Mm.
The little boys are having them on toast, and
man,
and
eggs are so good because the metabolic rate of the absorption of protein from an egg is nearly, I think it might even be 100%.
Yeah.
So they're so good for you. It's good food. Now, 5 eggs a day, are you getting through them, or what's the story?
Well, we are getting through them. Dee's a pretty keen baker, so she bakes lots of beautiful cakes and bits and pieces like that, and I'm a fairly aggressive egg eater, particularly when they're so tasty and fresh. But of course, we've sort of been saving them up, and if we have a weekend away, or we have friends, we send a few home with them, or our parents, or...
So what you're saying is I need to come round on the weekends more often.
Yeah, come round with your hand out, I think that's the go.
Or two.
Yeah, so, no, there definitely haven't been any gone to waste. We've got to be careful that our littlest bloke, in his excitement and running down the yard with the eggs, we've lost one to him having a stack, and...
Mm.
And,
did he get egg on his face?
Well, yes, he may well have done. But no, other than that, there's definitely been none sitting in the fridge for longer than they should be. And
mate, they say time heals all wounds, but I'm still as jealous today as I was when you first got them, and I'm just counting down the days till I get in and I can get them myself.
Well, speaking of which, it's not too many days to go, is it?
That's right. So one more question on the birds.
Yeah.
When you first got them, we sort of talked, or you mentioned that maybe you'd potentially look at more birds down the track. Is that still the case, or are you happy with the 6?
I think 6 laying hens is more than adequate for us in our situation. Look, we could have more, and you could just give more eggs away, I suppose. Yeah. But at the moment, I guess I don't feel the need to...
Because you've got a fairly solid supply.
And... We've got a solid supply, which is doing us, and there's probably a bit of spillover that we can hand out to some close friends and family. Yep. I think that we're comfortable at 6 at the moment. If we looked at expanding down the track, then possibly I'd look at getting some table birds in, yeah. Mm.
Yeah, I suppose once you get to a certain point and you've got enough of a supply of eggs, then you start tipping over into the... Now we're spending more money on feed, time to look after them.
That's
well.
Right, and making sure if you've already got adequate housing for them, then I suppose that's not a big deal. And look, really, they're pretty cheap to feed. You know, probably where the term chicken feed comes from.
I would imagine.
So I feel it's fairly economical to keep them going. But yeah, I suppose the initial outlay for the birds. It's
pretty high, really.
Yeah, yeah.
But once the infrastructure's there.
Yeah, that's right. Once the infrastructure's there, if you've got the room, you can really have as many as you want.
Up to 20.
Up to 20, yeah. Spoke about that in our last podcast, the regulations on your size of the yard. But really, it gets to a point where there's more than enough for our personal use and probably a bit of spillover that we can hand over. Yeah. And we're comfortable with that at the moment, yeah.
So... with the numbers, just if anyone missed our last podcast, if you're thinking about getting chooks in Queensland, the regulations are if you've got an urban block that is 800 square metres or less, you can have up to 6 laying hens. Up to 6 hens.
This is Brisbane City Council, by the way.
Yeah.
It could be different for Logan, Redlands, the Sunshine Coast, but this is...
Yeah, sorry, this is as specified on the BCC website.
Yeah.
If you've got over 800 square metres, you can have...
Up to 20
birds, that's right.
Which is, you know, geez. Well, you'd be getting close to 20 eggs a day if you had Isers.
That's right, yeah. and then you're deselling them at the market. So,
yeah.
So with that, we also mentioned in the last podcast about how you've been lining the coop and the laying boxes and et cetera with sugarcane mulch.
Yeah, it's readily available from, you know, hardware stores and landscaping supplies and garden centres. So, and it's and I thought, well, it's a comfort thing for them in their thing, in their coop, and it can be cleaned out regularly and then serve a second purpose of mulching the garden with an inbuilt fertiliser into it. Now, so that's what I'd done originally, is when I've cleaned the coop out sort of each week, I've chucked that on the garden. But you've come, you've done a little bit more research into that and found out something interesting, which I'll now deploy.
Yeah. So basically, because chicken manure is so high in nitrogen, actually, I'm not sure if it's the highest, but it's definitely one of the highest, it has the highest levels of nitrogen out of any of the usable animal manures that you can use in your garden. And because it's so high in nitrogen, if you throw it onto the garden fresh, it's considered what they call hot, and it can actually potentially, and well, quite in a reality, burn your plants, and can destroy them and can actually produce negative growth. So rather than taking it straight from the coop and putting it straight on the garden, which is potentially doing some serious damage to your plants, particularly the young plants, you actually have to enable that to decompose and compost the material before applying it.
Yeah, this is interesting. So that's something I'm going to definitely get happening, is just chucking it into a bit of a pile to compost down. And then, I mean, it's only going to benefit further from doing that.
So generally with compost, it's best to have two. So you've got one that you work on, and once you've filled that bay or that bin, then you start filling the other one. And generally, once you've filled the second bin, usually the first bin that you had filled or the first bay is at a good stage to distribute through the garden.
Yeah, that's a good system.
Yeah. So where, you know, you just in your... You're thinking towards using the mulch in the coop and having this manure mixed in with it actually works really well for this process of enabling the manure to break down.
Yeah.
Because what I found was that the manure, being so high in nitrogen, if it's left to be composted or decompose without any carbon-based materials, such as, you know, dry grass clippings, or your beloved sugarcane mulch, it actually causes it to overheat. So the chemical reaction of it breaking down, if it's left in its fresh raw state to break down on its own, it overheats and isn't effective. So you actually have to mix it with something like sugarcane mulch.
Well, yeah, well, that's convenient.
For it to break down. So. Yeah. So just adding in one step between the coop and the garden, but it will produce really good results because, as we know, plants love a good dose of nitrogen. So the sugarcane mulch with the chicken manure in it, once it's decomposed, is really going to be a good valuable asset. And you're making good use out of a byproduct of something else that's producing results in the garden. So it's a good cyclical system that you can implement.
And you're getting good nitrates into the soil in an organic fashion too.
Yeah,
you're not throwing handfuls of fertilizer around. So if some people are more into that than others, but if you want to take that organic approach, I suppose, like Jimmy said, it's an excellent way of using a waste product essentially to decompose, compost and fertilize your garden all in the one step, and it's organic. So it's the trifecta there.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting to note, actually, just in addition to this, I did some reading on that nitrogen level.
Yep.
And I'm obviously prefer organic matters to using manufactured fertilizers.
Yeah, well, wherever you can, I mean, who wouldn't?
Yeah. But what I found interesting is, even though chicken manure is so high in nitrogen, it actually is still only 1/8 of the nitrogen levels that is in blood and bone.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know...
Is blood and bone considered...
No.
Organic?
No, it's not. It's definitely manufactured, as far as I'm aware. But yeah, it's just one of those things. There's stuff's been grown on this earth forever without human made fertilizers. And where plants flourish is when we see things like, livestock that's on a hill, the rain washes the manure down the hill, and then there's good flourish of activity at the base of the hill. You know, so if we can replicate those kinds of scenarios in our garden and create a better system based on replicating what happens in nature, I think it's a more rewarding system to develop, rather than just throwing some man-made chemicals on the garden and just seeing the accelerated growth
yeah, for sure.
You sort of lose that in tune with nature effect that you get out of nurturing it.
Yeah, well, we touched on that a bit last time in our podcast that, you know, you can get fruit and vegetables now that looks flawless, it's big and looks fantastic, but it's lacking flavour and the eating quality that it once had, before it was tampered with by man. I mean, something's really been lost there, I think.
Yeah. Now, I also read somewhere a guy had two beds and he'd made one first and the second one he made at a later date. And when he made the first bed, he actually mixed cow manure through the bed. And the second one was an identical bed, but he had put chickens in and he started using chicken manure on there. And he hadn't allowed the process of decomposing the chicken manure with your grass clippings and things like that. And he'd just been putting it directly on the bed. And he was growing the same crop in both beds. And he noticed that the one with the cow manure was doing really, really well and the chicken manure one wasn't. And he knew that the chicken manure had more nitrogen, so he just assumed that it should do better, but in fact it was doing a lot worse than the cow manure one. And it just comes down to that level of nitrogen, and the cow manure is fine to put straight on fresh,
right?
Because of the amount of nitrogen that's in the cow manure versus the chicken. So
there you go.
Pretty interesting.
Very interesting. Yeah.
Now, while we're on the subject of gardens, we sort of touched on your gardening efforts, and I know that being as busy as you are and enjoying healthy protein rich eggs, maybe it's been put on the back burner, but what's the update? What's happening?
Well, yeah, you're quite right. I probably haven't put quite as much time into it as I should have. We got six small basil plants into the ground, and I planted a jalapeno chili tree.
Mm-hmm.
Into the ground, and
there's three of them out the back at the moment in pots.
Yeah, well,
I'm looking forward to those things.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get another one going because I planted the chili tree in an area where the chooks have access to it,
mm-hmm.
and it was a beautiful, healthy specimen when it went into the ground, and it was all mulched around, and it was watered and loved and nurtured, and then within a week, the chooks, when I'm at work, they free range in the yard, they've been in there scratching like there's no tomorrow. And
so it's not actually in the fenced off area, but they have access to it when you let them out during the day.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And look, you know, it's my own fault, really. I knew that I should have probably fenced off around it, but it has been hammered by, initially I thought it might have been bugs and pests sort of eating the leaves, but I've since sort of worked out that I think that it's the chooks pecking away the leaves.
Chooks are most likely to go for the bugs first and eliminate that population.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, it's had a bit of a hard time, the old jalapeno tree. But on the other hand, the basil's been planted in another garden bed that I've got on.
So is the basil in the raised beds and the chili wasn't?
They're both in raised beds, but one's on the wrong side of the fence, I suppose.
The other side of the tracks.
Yeah, that's right. So the one on the chook side, which is the jalapeno tree, yeah, it's been hit badly. But
is it in it, can it survive?
I think it'll survive. I'm actually considering transplanting it. I mean, I it's almost at the stage where I don't think I have much to lose. It was a beautiful tree covered in foliage and it started flowering.
Maybe fence it off first to
let it recoup.
Yeah, because of the transplant shock if it's already gone through
that once. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that is something I'll have to look at doing is getting that on. But on the other hand, the basil that we've whacked in the ground on the other side of the fence in a raised bed is doing really well. I mulched around that with sugarcane mulch. We already had a bit of parsley growing in that little herb garden, and the rest of it just been overrun with weeds, and I just weeded it out,
yep.
Chucked the basil in the ground, sugarcane mulch around it and watered it, and it's over, it's more than doubled in size since the sun. It's doing really well.
We've had quite a lot of rain.
We have. We've had fantastic conditions, really, for growing.
Mm.
That also means weeds grow fantastically well as well, so you've got to keep on top of them. But since mulching it with the sugarcane mulch, minimal have come through, and it's just good. So easy just to pick them out. So,
and you really don't have to mulch very often, like maybe once every 6 months, if that.
Yeah, that's right. So
once a year, or once a season.
Excited by those results, we picked up a few more seedlings today.
All right.
So we've got some coriander and some mint and some rosemary to go in. So we're sort of going to make that one a dedicated herb garden now. Yep.
They're all so you're really buying well. Seedlings?
We're buying seedlings just for herbs at this stage.
Mate.
But I've also bought potting mix, seed raising mix, and some other bits and pieces at the garden centre this morning. Yeah. So I'm going to get some plants going from seeds, and you've
had
experience in this too.
When I go to my new place, I'm going to get some seedlings, even though, I mean, you know how big my seed bank is, but this late in the growing season, I really want to get on, like hit the ground running with the new place, and I've got to build the beds and things like that, which we'll talk about soon, but I, you know, in those sorts of scenarios, you know, it makes sense to get seedlings. And I've started trying to prepare for it. So I've got two trays of 24 out there. One's full of brown onions and the other one's full of coriander. And it's not going to be enough coriander for me because I eat it like lettuce.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's one of those things where it makes sense to get seedlings. So that's what I'll do there.
Yeah, well, we're just, I suppose, through laziness, and I don't have a huge amount of seeds to call on. Yeah, time at the moment. So it's nice just to get a few things in the ground that are already established. Mm. But I also can see the benefits of producing something from a seed. And, you know, we're going to do that. Some of those broccoli seeds that I got off you, actually, I'm going to whack them into some trays. I've got that seedling raising mix.
It's good to do both.
Yeah.
Get some seedlings in the ground and then, you know, you've got something established and work on your seeds on the side as well.
Yeah, so, no, that's
and that way
right.
You get a bit of a rotation.
Yeah, you can stagger your harvest. That's right.
So it's like when I plant my radishes, I'll plant half of as dedicated space and then, you know, a couple of weeks later I'll plant the other half so that I've got them maturing at different stages so that I've always got something on the go.
And that's the best way to do it. If you can plan ahead like that, then, you know, you get use of your veggies that, you know, we're not in a commercial situation where, you know, you plan out a whole garden bed and all of a sudden you've got, you know, 20 square metres of broccoli, you know, already at once or something, you know, like that. If you can do it that way where you plan out a section, a couple of weeks later plan out another, and you've got it within the growing season, then, you've staggered your harvest and it's a much better situation for the small producer for their own benefit.
For those types of crops, like things like my snow peas, you know, you just plant them all at the same time because they flower and produce crop, you know, during that time.
Yeah.
And you can just sort of graze on it throughout the season. But now, you were looking at building another raised bed by the olive tree. Is that on hold as well?
It's on hold at the moment. It's still getting consideration, but and it will come through eventually. But at the moment, I'm just trying to work with what I've got.
Yeah.
I've just work's consuming far more of my time at the moment than I'd like it to be. But that's just the way it goes sometimes. So, in the limited spare time I've had at the moment, that's the reason we've bought seedlings, and we're just working with a couple of small raised beds that we've got, and we will expand on that when time allows, and hopefully that's soon.
Well, because I wanted to pose something to you, working smarter, not harder, and by that I mean when I move into my new house that I've just bought with Paul, I'm going to be buying the materials to build my own raised beds, so maybe we can do it at the same time and maybe even, I wouldn't say potentially saving on material costs, but we can certainly use each other's enthusiasm to get the job done over a weekend. And
that's, that is a big part of it. Sometimes, you know, when you're busy, you can get sort of locked down in your situation and you can forget about things that actually help you get out of that lull. Mm. And having someone else that's like-minded, and it rekindles that flame, and you know it gets you excited, and in turn when you get into the garden and get your hands in the dirt and start producing something and seeing something grow, you know, that
Yeah, you need that constant stream of inspiration to
keep up. You do, sometimes, is the way it can be.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's it. And, I could use your tools as well.
The truth comes out. Yeah. I suppose you probably want me to build them for you.
Yeah, I'll just stand off and take photos like the chicken coop. Nah, definitely getting my hands dirty for that stuff.
Good man.
And the other thing, I suppose, and it's probably a similar answer, but I know that you were potentially looking at removing a hedge that was running down the side of your house and replacing it with some trellises and putting some snow peas in. I think you mentioned probably the biggest obstacle to overcome there is potentially pitching the idea to the family.
Yeah, well, look, the idea has been put out there, and that hedge is the bane of my life. I don't like the hedge, yeah. But my wife does. So what we've decided is she doesn't like it where it is, but likes the hedge, and I'd like to use that area to produce snow peas.
It's not a very snaps. It's not a nice hedge, though. It's that I can't remember the name of it. When I used to be a gardener, I was forever trimming them, and all I could ever think of was, why would you spend a little bit less to get this yellow thorny shrub when you can get something just a little bit, few more dollars, and get something as beautiful as a mock orange or a Maria?
Yeah,
same plant, different names, but yeah. You know, it's soft. You can, you know, brush
and this is up the thing I'm trying to pitch to Dee. Dee's idea now is to actually transplant that hedge somewhere else, and I just want to.
No, it's a horrible, horrible hedge.
I might have to get you to have a word with her because we're locking horns on that one at the moment. But anyway, she's happy for it to go from where it is. Yeah. So the bean idea,
in order to transplant it, you'd have to cut a fair amount of growth off it for it to be successful, so you might as well just get young Marias anyway.
Mm.
And they're a much, much more beautiful
hedge. Yeah, Maria is a beautiful hedge.
They thick out nicely. They've got the lovely dark green leaves, the white flowers that come out.
Little orange berries.
Orange berries, where the mock orange name comes from.
Yeah. No, it is a beautiful hedge. I'm a big fan of Maria.
Yeah.
If you're going to put in a hedge that doesn't produce something for the table, that's the one I'd put in.
Yeah. And, so when that moves, then potentially putting in some snow peas.
Yeah.
Mate, the other thing too that I thought would be good while you got the young kids is growing a tunnel. So put up some trellises in a tunnel and then grow the snow peas up like that. And that creates like a little haven that the boys can run through, and they can be picking snow peas, and it's giving them something fun to do, and it's healthy, and it's just, I think, something pretty cool.
Yeah, that is cool. That is a good idea. I might look at where we could fit something like that in.
Yeah, definitely. Speaking of fitting things in, hunting.
Yes, haven't done as much of it this year as I'd like, but we're getting into the better season for it soon, the cooler weather, so hopefully getting out and...
And what is it about the cooler weather? Is it comfort-wise, or is it just better for the animals are stocked up after a feed?
Yeah, well, they've done well normally through the... the warmer season. Winter's normally a harder time, but also it is more comfortable to be walking the hills, and it's also a little bit more convenient in southeast Queensland to have the cooler weather if you want to hang meat overnight and things like that. You don't have quite the heat.
Is it lower production for the farmer as well, so you're not getting in their way or anything like that, or is that not really
an issue? No, that where I hunt, it's not really an issue with that. No. I'm not on any cropping properties or anything like that. To be honest,
sheep station?
Yeah, they run sheep, livestock. Yeah, wool sheep basically. Okay. And to be honest, most farmers are happy to have everything off their land other than the sheep or the stock that they're running. That's just the mentality of a farmer, and you can understand why. That's their livelihood. They don't want other animals eating grass and
it's also
attacking their herd.
It's also everyone else's livelihood as well, because it's a major supporter of our economy in Australia. So
yeah, indeed. So yeah, that is something that hopefully I'll get out into the hills a bit more and can put some free range organic meat on the table for a very low cost. Mm. So it's rewarding in a lot of ways for me.
Your old mate Jim out with you.
Yeah, well, look, I realise that it's not for everyone, but I'm not a vegetarian. I enjoy eating meat, and I you know, a lot of people are quite okay with someone going fishing and catching a fish and bringing that home and putting that on the table. Yep. And, you know, and I see hunting, if it's done ethically and humanely, is just as rewarding. And you know, meat's becoming more and more expensive all the time. And you can go out into the bush and harvest an animal that, in a lot of cases, is a feral animal anyway.
Yeah.
And
well, it's vermin control as well. And, mate, well, you know me, I was a vegetarian for nearly 8 years.
Yes, you finally came back to your senses.
Yeah, well, it the reason I gave it up, well, one of the fundamental reasons was because of the, I guess, overproduction of meats and things like that. I mean, you look at, you know, chickens in battery in for your eggs and stuff like that, and there's a whole raft of reasons. And being on that side, and now I'm, you know, I'm all for, you know, gathering your own meat sources, rearing your own animals and all that sort of stuff. I think the questionable is those that actively eat meat and then have issues with you know, hunting.
And there's a huge amount of them out there. I must admit that, and I see it as being quite hypocritical, actually.
So they're happily vegetarians, they stand for something, and they believe in something, and then they act accordingly and in a non-hypocritical way, unless they're running around in leather shoes and things like that. Yeah. But for the most part, a vegetarian, excellent, mate. I've been there. I did that for nearly a decade, and I was...
And that, I mean, that is an excellent effort. And I've got lots of friends that are vegetarians, and, you know, everyone can make their own choice, and that's the beauty of...
Yep.
You know,
but I have a problem too with those that they won't eat a rabbit because they're furry and fluffy, but they'll eat an intensively reared chicken.
They're happy to go down to KFC and eat a burger where the chickens live for 35 days to produce that meat.
Yeah, and they can barely stand because of
them. They can't. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, it's just you. I think part of it is innocent ignorance, if you will. You know, they don't really understand where their meat comes from, and therefore they just have an idea of what is right and what is wrong that's somewhat misguided because they're not really taking an effort into realizing where their food comes from.
That's right. Yeah, they're so far removed from the process, and look, a lot of us are, because, you know, that's the nature of modern society, I suppose. But I like to take a little bit of responsibility of where my food comes from. And
make choices,
and look, I think that if you go out and you, I'm happy to go hunting, and I'll dispatch an animal humanely and quickly and cleanly, and at the end of it, I'll treat that animal with the respect that it deserves, and I'll use every bit of meat I can off the carcass, and it'll be thoroughly enjoyed, and, you know, at least that animal has lived a life that it was supposed to have lived up, and even though it may be deemed that it was shorter because it's been dispatched, it hasn't been, you know, inside a shed, never seeing the light of day, and produced.
There's no question in it. Once you understand. So that said, and this is for my own benefit, because I'm going to be bugging you to take me out soon. Now that my license is just around the corner. On the property that you assist in vermin control, what animals are suitable for the table out of that, and what are just purely for vermin control for the farmer's land?
Well, the suitable table animals are the feral goats, and they're beautiful eating. A young
curry goat apparently is really, really nice.
Gumbeng curry, I think it's called in Malaysia.
Yeah, it's also a South American dish, I believe.
Mm. Goat's eaten more widely in the world than any other meat, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah,
it's it's fantastic, mate. It's it really is lovely. I've eaten quite a few of the goats that I've taken. Well, in fact, pretty much all of them. Mm. And you know, I thoroughly enjoy it, and so that's a really good one.
Yep.
Deer, venison, if you can grasp one of those, then you're doing really well. And that's one of the finest game meats in the world.
Yeah.
And I got one of them late last year, when we were doing a bit of a trip, and it was just to die for. It was it really was beautiful.
Rabbits. Deer liver apparently is really nice as well.
Yeah, apparently it is. I think it's a stronger flavoured liver. Yeah, but look, let's be honest, not many people eat any offal at all anymore, which I think that's a crime in itself. That it's almost considered dog food to most people nowadays, whereas once upon a time they were the prized cuts.
Yep.
You know, that often at off so a carcass.
So much nutrients in them.
Mm. I had devil kidneys this week twice, and whew, good fodder.
Yeah. I love liver. I think that, you know, there's not enough of it in animals.
Very high in iron. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the deer, if you can get deer, we don't see them as often, but yeah, on the properties that I've got, but I'm sort of putting the feelers out there to get onto a few more. There's plenty of them around. Yeah. And,
well, I've got a few potentials up around the Taroom area.
Yeah, great.
You know, one of Dad's cousins owns a cattle and sheep station up there, and she owns hundreds of acres. Wow. Thousands of hectares.
So, yeah. No, that's fantastic.
So, okay, goats and the odd deer. Is there anything else that's just pure? What about hogs and? Oh.
Yeah, well, look, there's always normally feral pigs and foxes around, and obviously, if you get a young pig, that's you got to be careful with parasites in pigs. Yeah. There's a worm, and they can often have TB. Mm. So you got to know what you're looking for in a pig. But if you get a young pig that has, and different properties, they eat different things. Like if you get pigs off a grain property or something like that, where they're mainly just eating grain, then they're great. But in a lot of areas, they eat carrion and dead animals, and you know, you got to be a bit wary.
So they're more just.
But you know, pigs will take lambs. So the farmer's always happy to get rid of any pigs.
Yeah.
And also foxes as well, and wild dogs. They're the three just that are purely pretty much vermin control. And the only other one that's comes up regularly that's table and vermin control in the one thing is the humble rabbit. And, you know, they're fantastic eating. Oh, they're good sport.
They're so good.
I mean, you know, it's and there's plenty of them.
And they're quick and easy to clean too, so.
They are, yeah. And look, you know, they've tried introducing the Khaleesi's virus and myxomatosis, and that's had incredible effects. But, you know, it's good fun, really, to go out and do a bit of rabbit shooting, and it's great meat to put on the table. And
I mean, they were spread by people it was just like a guaranteed source of meat. Originally, they'd just turn up, here's a new land, release a couple of rabbits, and boom. They knew that they could sail off, and they could come back, and they knew that they would have a source of meat there. And I've heard stories of ships actually dropping off, you know, dozens of rabbits onto islands on their journey through to two major destinations, so that if ever they got shipwrecked and marooned on an island, that they have potentially, you know, put this source of meat onto somewhere where they would, you know, potentially be able to get to after a shipwreck. So
no, they did the same thing with the pigs. That's how the feral pigs were introduced into the country by Captain Cook.
Mm. So,
and that's why there's huge numbers of them in Cape York too.
Yeah, they're just so destructive on the land. They're just tractors, absolutely, basically, just hoarding up,
rooting up the soil. Yeah, that's it.
Oh, that's good. Once I'm settled into the house, I'll be hitting you up pretty hard to go out and go on a
spend we'll go a weekend and do a spot away. Of that for sure.
Mm. So my now,
Jim, you your house settles pretty soon.
Yeah, 2 weeks or just under, actually. March 30, we get the keys, 10 a.m. And I've actually arranged for some holidays, some much-needed holidays. Yeah. I don't know how. I mean, it's logical to take the holidays, moving into a new property and setting up, but I've taken a bit of extra, and it actually runs into Easter, so that's going to give me enough time to move in, and it's also going to give me enough time to start setting up some of what I call essential elements into the property. So
that's exciting. Well, let's hear about these essential elements. What do you got planned?
Well, the first thing I do is assess where it's all going.
Yeah, well, that's right. You've got to sort of be in a place to work out where the sun.
Yeah, and I've had a look on Google Maps and trying to have a look at the sun pattern and things like that, just based on where's north bearing and things like that. But I think number one is I want to get some raised beds in there that I mentioned before. minimum of three decent sized beds, and that's to assist in crop rotation.
Yeah.
So you have your roots in one, you have your brassicas in one, you have your legumes in one, and then every season you rotate them through.
Yeah, that's so a good plan.
So the legumes are putting the nitrogen back into the soil and you know, repairing the soil after the roots and brassicas have been through. So minimum of three. I'd actually prefer to have six. So if I go with six, there'll be six smaller beds.
Yeah.
But again, it's just I've got to do a site assessment, see what prop land I can utilize. I can't, obviously I'm not tearing up the whole backyard to make it full production. That's not sort of the aim of the game yet. I have gone in with my brother, who's not as keen on all this as I am.
Fair enough.
Even though he's a chef and you know, he grows a mean herb garden in some bread crates out the back of his restaurant.
Well, that's a good start.
Yeah, but, you know, that's, it's again, site assessment, and you know, I'll probably write some things on that and take some photos and go with that. So either six smaller beds or three major beds.
Okay.
Now, the other element to that, which coincides with the site assessment, is where the chooks are going, because that's a must. That's in the first 2 weeks of moving in. Chooks straight away.
Yeah.
While I've got the time. So I'm taking 10 days off, or I think it works out to be about 11 with the public holidays from Easter.
Okay.
So, and we'll be fairly efficient moving in and getting everything set up. So.
And how many chooks do you think you're going to look at getting?
I think I'm going to go six as well.
Yep.
Yep. I like the number. I'm a fan of threes for no particular reason, but so I couldn't have five, I'd have to have six.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sounds good.
Yep, so I think it's a good number anyway, and I can sure as hell eat a lot of eggs, and I know Paul will eat them as well, so they're my two priorities as far as production, you know, my veg and a protein source.
Now, your third one was going to be looking into solar, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Let's hear about that.
So, I went to the home show and started picking some brains about solar and things like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of information out there about it.
Yeah, I think when you do your own research online, you learn about the elements and you learn about deals and you learn about pricing and you learn about all that sort of stuff. But the real practical knowledge comes from asking all the right questions from an array of people. And
yeah, so you're not just getting pushed one product or one particular system.
So I actually spoke to people who were selling the cheap stuff.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you just think, wow, this is great. I can get a 5 kilowatt system for $5,000.
Yeah.
And, but then I also spoke to people who were selling what's deemed as commercial grade panels, where a 5 kilowatt system could, for 400 watt panels, and about 24 panels, cost $17,000.
Mm.
So I started at the top and worked down. Actually, I started at the top, went to the very bottom, and then spoke to someone in the middle. And I learnt a fair bit of stuff about the different kinds of panels. And the guy who was the most expensive, to his credit, he didn't try to discourage me from going cheaper. He just said, these are some things to look at. And there's the way that the energy is drawn off the cell is taken back via these bus bars, which connect all the cells. That's what they call them. And that's the silver strips that you see running down to connect all the cells. And he said the newer systems have three of these per line of cells, and the older technology only has two.
Okay.
The other thing is they talk about the wattage per panel as well, so you can get sort of 160, 180, which... watt panels, which are the older technology and generally have the two bus bars, and then they can go up to, I think, the tier, what might be referred to as tier one, is 250 watt panels. Wow. And then the commercial grade panels are 400 watt.
Jeez.
Yeah. But with that, you've got efficiency of the panel and all this sort of stuff, and that's where you can learn a lot about the technology, but then how does it apply in a real world. And I finally found a gentleman. And I won't give information about all these different companies, obviously, for obvious reasons, but this guy seemed to speak a lot of good sense, or he made sense the way he spoke, and he actually raised a point between the two different kinds of the technology and the panels, and that's the difference between polycrystalline and monocrystalline panels.
Yep.
So traditionally, polycrystalline are cheaper panels, and monocrystalline are the more expensive ones.
Okay.
So you'll find that a lot of the higher end companies that sell the more expensive packages tend to be monocrystalline, and some of the really cheap ones are polycrystalline. But this guy actually said that it's not so much about which type you go for is going to produce a better result. It's your situation that deems necessary to choose the right kind of panel. And in some cases, choosing some monocrystalline and some polycrystalline will give you a better result than sticking with one or the other.
Right.
So, and whether or not it's true or not, he did speak to me in very practical terms. And he mentioned that although the polycrystalline panels don't produce as much as the monocrystalline, they're actually more efficient when you've got a non-northern facing panel.
Yeah, well, that's the thing with solar, isn't it? They normally said it's ideally if you can face your panels due north.
Due north, because they get in the most amount of sun.
And they get the biggest solar contribution.
That's yeah. Right. So if you have the ability to put, like, let's say, for instance, I went with a modest system of a 3 kilowatt. Now, a 3 kilowatt is likely to produce enough power for me to eliminate my bill, the way that we save power. But as prices and things like that change with what you feed back into the grid and what that balance of what you're feeding back on a dollar value changes in the future, then a 3 kilowatt system might not potentially. And it's going to save you money, but it's not going to actually make you any money feeding it back to the grid. So if you've got eastern facing or western facing, or you can't get the right angle, even on a north facing, if you can't specifically get the right angle, then a polycrystalline panel works more efficiently.
Yeah.
Whereas the monocrystalline is better if it's just facing due north and you've got the right angles.
Sure. Okay. Well, that's interesting. Yeah. So everyone's situation will be different with that.
Yep. Obviously there's still a lot more that I need to research about it. And looking at my situation, I do have half my roof facing due north, but it's shaded somewhat by some trees, and they're in the neighbor's yard. Mm. And they're huge gum trees. So
yeah.
Whether, even if I get a top-notch system on the roof, how much shade it's going to be. And something else I found out is that if you get shade on the panel, it actually shuts the panel off.
Wow.
So to combat that, they've got these what they call bypass diodes, and that essentially segments each panel. So if you get shade on one quarter of the panel,
it doesn't shut the whole panel down.
It just shuts down that corner of it. Generally they'll have three bypass diodes, so it splits the panel into three. Otherwise the really expensive ones had six, but in my opinion, if you're going to get some shade on, it's probably not going to be 1/6 of a panel. And the difference, I think 1/3 is sufficient enough to help. So
sure.
So anyway, there's still a lot more to learn about, and that's something I can maybe come back.
Yeah, to later. There's more points that we could bring up on solar, but I'd say we'll bring them up down the track. Yep.
So if anyone has anything interesting or some good articles explaining some of this stuff, feel free to share it with the show. I'd love to hear the feedback. All right, that's pretty much it, I think, as far as what's going on. But one thing I wanted to run through real quick with you, Joel, and with our listeners, is I found an interesting article by someone named Laura Larum. I think that's how you pronounce her last name. She's a contributor over at the Permaculture Research Institute of Australia. And I just happened to stumble on this. I think it was a link on the Facebook page from Grassroots Magazine, and what it is building your own worm farm.
Great.
So we've spoken in the past about potentially buying a worm farm.
Mm.
But then go and have a look at the cost of them. I mean, they're between sort of $60 and $100 depending on what size you get and what brand. And then there's, you know, buying some worms on top of that if you're just going to buy them. Personally, I prefer to dig them out of under my compost and transplant and move them that way. But
yeah,
a pretty big cost involved. But what Laura has posted over at the Permaculture Research Institute website, permaculture.org.au, is how to make what she refers to as the worm mansion. So, and it pretty much, as far as I can see, pretty much costs you nothing.
Well, it sounds good.
So, it consists of, obviously a worm farm consists of a number of different layers.
Yeah.
You've got your base layer, which is where the liquid that's produced by the worms eating and decomposing all of the waste that you put in there, the composting waste, and that's potentially liquid gold, that stuff.
Yeah, the best liquid fertilizer.
Best liquid fertilizer.
Organic, anyway, the best organic liquid fertilizer.
That's right. So you generally have a base layer, which is where that drains into, and then there's a tap that you can drain off
into, draw it off into
a bucket or whatnot. So, so I looked at Laura's design here, and I'll run through how to make it because it's really easy. It's just a few steps. And then I'll add a potential modification to it to make it, I think, a little bit more practical.
Yep.
But basically, you know those polystyrene boxes that you...
Broccoli boxes and things like that?
Exactly. Yep. That the fruiterer will get all their supply of vegetables in.
Yep.
So usually they just throw them out or whatnot. So I'm sure that, you know, if you go and ask them nicely, can I have a few, that they'll give you them.
Yeah, we've grabbed them in the past for a makeshift esky.
Yeah, that's right.
So, and they're quite good.
I actually use them to plant carrots and all sorts of stuff in. The deep ones are good for that. So, yeah. They're just awesome, I think, for any self-sustaining character. So, three of those will supply you with the base layer and then two composting layers above that you stack on.
Okay.
You just need three of those and then one lid from one of those boxes as well, which is going to be the top of the layers. So obviously they need to be all the same size you can stack them. Now, the first box, which is always at the bottom, and this is the collection chamber, if you will, you drill one hole in the bottom of it to allow the juice to drain out.
Okay.
And the hole size is between sort of 2 to 3 centimeters, so about an inch.
Mm-hmm.
And that's to drain out. The other two boxes will be stacked on top of it, obviously. And what you should do with those is to enable that liquid to drain through them. You have a series of holes in the bottom layer, in the bottom of both of those. So probably around 45 holes.
Yeah.
So... And they should only sort of be about 5 to 10 mil.
Yeah.
So not as big as the draining hole on the bottom layer.
Yeah, but otherwise too much stuff would fall through.
Yeah, that's right. So you just put all the holes through, and I mean, you can even just do it with a screwdriver if you haven't got any tools. But you just pop them all through, and then at this stage you can get the kids involved if you want, and you can have them decorate the outside of the boxes, and they can make it look like a apartment block, or, you know, draw some double rainbows on there or something. So you can get the kids involved, and it's a good art activity for them, and then also gets them encouraged about working in the garden and looking after a worm farm. And, you know, what kid doesn't like playing with worms?
This is true, as long as they don't eat them.
Yeah, well, a bit of extra protein never hurt anyone. So I guess the only recommendation with that side of it, with the decorating, that Laura points out, which is a good point, is to use acrylic paint if you're going to be painting it.
Yeah, styrofoam's, excuse me, a bit sensitive to solvents, and the enamel-based paint would probably eat into it a bit.
Yeah, exactly. So any oil-based paint or solvent, you know, it'll go solvent-soluble paint will destroy the box. So
yeah.
Avoid that. Keep in mind that the bottom box will always be the ground floor of the block, basically. So the other two will take turns of being the first and second floor, so as stuff starts to decompose.
Yeah.
And then from there, you know, you're just rotating them through. Okay, so the first layer that is going to be your composting layer, or where the worms are going to live, you pop that on top of the base layer, and then you just cover the floor on top of those 45 or so holes with a layer of newspaper.
Okay.
And then fill it with uncompressed moist soil. So ideally organic potting mix with some compost.
Okay.
Okay, but don't compact it down.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yep. And you fill that layer to about 10 to 15 centimeters in depth. And then you add some composting worms. So whether you buy these or you dig them up out of your own garden or out of a friend or family's garden, if they've got good soil, doesn't matter.
Do you need many worms to start with?
Not really, because if you've got the right conditions, so say between 15 to 25 degrees, yep. So in a relatively cool area, particularly in southeast Queensland or Queensland in general, or anywhere in the top end, and you've got good air circulation, a good amount of moisture as well, and you provide them with enough food, I'm told that the numbers of worms will actually double in around 40 days.
Oh, wow, that's good.
Yep, so even if you start with 25 worms, you're going to have 50 in 40 days.
Yeah.
And so on. So that said as well, if you've purchased the worms and you pop them in, it's probably not a good idea to feed them straight away as well. So generally when you buy worms, there's some food for them in there.
Yeah.
So just make sure you spread that bulk of the material out nice and even throughout, and allow around 24 hours for the worms to settle in before adding any more of your scraps for them to decompose for you. Then you just cover with a Hessian bag or any woolen or cotton type rag, and then pop the lid on.
Hit the greengrocer up for that one as well, I suppose. So yeah. You're getting the broccoli boxes.
Yeah, and I've actually seen, you know, worm mats that you can buy and things like that, but, I mean, it's just all...
The humble potato sack will work just as well, though.
Yeah, absolutely. And that just helps keep the moisture in and keep it the environment right as that compost level reaches up to the top, and then, of course, you can move on to the next level.
Great.
So, obviously, it needs to be in an elevated position, so you can position a bucket underneath the hole in the bottom of the base layer, and that's where the liquid fertilizer, essentially, or the worm juice is actually going to flow out and collect in that bucket. So, my one suggestion with this setup is to potentially not put just a straight hole in the bottom, but actually just buy a tap. I mean, they're about $1.50. And you can just cut the hole and screw it into the side. There's no reason why it won't.
And
won't
some seal. Of that, I think that is a good idea. And the ones that I've seen in the prefab worm farms that you buy have got a tap on.
Yeah,
the bottom. And it just has to be a simple little quarter turn ball valve type tap.
Yeah, and it's
irrigation type tap or something.
Yeah, it's something simple like the old camping water jugs used to buy. And
yeah, you can just draw it off when you need it.
Yeah, and those boxes are large enough to house quite a bit of liquid.
Yeah, that absolutely.
Yep. So I guess the only other thing to consider is to just put it on a slight incline toward.
Give it a little bit of fall to one end. Yeah.
Yep. As a plumber, you know, help me with the right angles and a bit of angle to let it drain towards the tap, basically. Yeah. And that's it. So, you know, to start with, you only need two boxes, the base layer and the one level above that. But once the first level's full, you can add the second box and just keep adding your compost to it.
Sounds good.
Simple and easy and cheap and seems to be very effective. So I'm going to build one of those as soon as I get
that's a good plan. Anyway, so. I might get onto that as well.
Yeah. Oh, well, that just about brings us to the end of the audio diary. I hope you enjoyed listening and continue to follow us on our journey. So be sure to subscribe. And if you have any questions or advice you'd like to share with the show, please feel free to send us an email to info@theurbanfarmers.tv. And we'll do our best to read it on the show and have a discussion around your inquiry or share your tips and advice with our listeners.